Hey, Dark City fans, this is Leah.
And this is April.
For the first of what we hope will be many episodes to come, we knew we had to come out heavy-hitting to start, so the story we are going to tell you today has everything. Rocket science, the occult, mansions, communists, NASA, the FBI, even Scientology, and an accidental death that might have been murder. And all of that revolves around one man, Jack Parsons, who was one of the principal founders of NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab. This is Dark City, Season 1, Los Angeles. Welcome to episode number one. If you're listening to this right now, it probably means you are listed somewhere in our family trees or a personal friend that we beg to listen. Either way, welcome. Before we dive into this crazy story, a quick introduction to ourselves and the podcast. April and I have been working on this podcast for months, but we go all the way back to middle school.
Yes, we sat down and we figured this out just recently because we were like, how long has it really been? We bonded over an episode of SNL. We watched the same episode. We came back to class and we started talking about it. And then not long after started getting in trouble for talking too much.
In class. Yes, I know. And I remember our teacher, our science teacher signed your yearbook.
I think so.
Like, you have such a lovely smile, except when it's you're turned around and talking to Leah or something like that.
Yes.
It's like my only detention. We talked about more than Saturday Night Live.
But we did.
Anyway. So with our shared interest in crazy stories, especially dark stories and strange but true history and general common sense of humor, we decided to package up the stuff we would read about and talk about over dinner anyway into a podcast. So here we go. You're welcome. For the first season, Los Angeles is the perfect city to kick off the series because this area has experienced every dark shade of scandal long before it became the sprawling metropolis we call Los Angeles. Even the water source that made this gigantic city possible is a story of scandal and tragedy. Also, this place, if you haven't noticed, is a hotbed for serial killers and cults. And of course, we'll throw in some of the more well-known and some of the lesser-known dark tales from Hollywood. But first, I knew I wanted to begin our series with the story of Jack Parsons. Mm-hmm. When I first learned about his life and work, my first reaction was, wait, what? Jack was a pioneering rocket scientist by day, but by night, he was a black magic occult leader? How could such a bright scientific mind also believe in things that require a crazy leap in logic? In the book Strange Angel by George Pendle, which details the life and times of Jack Parsons, there is a quote that explains Jack's thought process. It has seemed to me that if I had the genius to found the jet propulsion field in the U.S. and found a multi-million dollar corporation and a world-renowned research laboratory, then I should also be able to apply this genius in the magical field.
It makes total sense. Somehow.
It makes something. It makes one heck of a life. So in addition to showing his logic, also this shows Jack's, shall we say, grandiosity and delusion. In fact, while Jack was no doubt a genius and instrumental in all of these things, he by no means did any of them alone. He was one of several incredibly talented people that came together at just the right place and time to make it all possible. In fact, depending on who is telling the story, different people get different levels of credit for their overall contribution to the field of rocket science and what would one day become NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab. But none of these gifted individuals that you'll meet throughout the story had hobbies and eccentricities quite like Jack, who is the stuff that mad scientist stereotypes are made of. So let's start first with some background on Jack's upbringing and the time period and place in which he came of age.
Okay.
So taking you all the way back to 1914, Jack was born on October 2nd of that year to parents Ruth and Marvel Parson. Ruth and Marvel both came from well-to-do families. Ruth, born into a wealthy manufacturing family, and Marvel's father, a real estate developer. They met and married in Springfield, Massachusetts, but sadly, less than a year into their marriage, Ruth gave birth to a stillborn, and her health was very fragile.
Oh, that's so sad.
I know. So they decided to make a change and move to this new up-and-coming city called Los Angeles, like so many were at that time, filled with opportunity and a climate more agreeable to Ruth's health. When they arrived, LA looked very different than it does today. So no 405, no smog, no urban sprawl. It looked more like California's reputation, the Garden of America, with an abundance of orange groves, vineyards, flowers, and sunshine.
Sounds nice.
But no city can escape the dark shadows of life. Ruth got pregnant very soon after their arrival to Los Angeles, but unfortunately, Marvel was already succumbing to the dark delights of the new city and began cheating on her with a sex worker.
Oh my gosh.
I know. And can you imagine coming all that way? They didn't have any family with them immediately.
She probably felt stranded in this city, this new place with this husband that was...
It's not like you can take a commercial flight.
Yeah.
You know, 1914. So... Fortunately, though, for her, she found out and she divorced him pretty quickly, a few months after Jack was born. And for the most part, Marvel does remain absent from Jack's life. But fortunately for Ruth, her parents were nearing retirement. They moved to LA and buy a house in the nearby up-and-coming city of Pasadena, where Ruth and Jack move in with them. Their house is a modest 20-room abode on a street called Millionaire's Row. Because, I mean, everyone needs 20 bedrooms.
I never understood this until I started watching Downton Abbey. And then I was like, oh, this is what all these extra rooms are for. You just have, you know, 15 people come and stay for a month or two.
Right. And then you need rooms for staff. And
I guess,
if I could buy a 20 bedroom house, I would not buy a 20 bedroom house.
Oh, it sounds terrible to clean.
Yeah. Even though they have a staff.
Yeah.
But... Well, and it does become a problem later on Millionaire's mm-hmm. Row, but we'll talk about that actually just in just a moment. So I'll give you a brief background on Millionaire's Row itself, since it's a street where Jack spends a good portion of his life.
Okay.
So Millionaire's Row is actually Orange Grove Boulevard today, the street where the Rose Bowl Parade starts every New Year's Day. At the time the Parsons were moving in, it was over a mile stretch of mansions owned by people with last names you might recognize. Wrigley, Anheuser-Busch, the wife of J.W. Robinson, as in the department store. Unfortunately, though, like I mentioned, you can't see many of the estates today because they were abandoned and overrun after their owners had to vacate them in the Great Depression.
Oh, okay.
So it turns out that when a lot of them were wiped out mm-hmm. during the Great Depression, there's not really a big market for your highly customized 20-bedroom house.
Sure, I can see that.
So while this is absolutely still a gorgeous area today, very green in every style of house you can imagine, they're no longer there. They've been replaced with condos. One famous house you might know, the Gamble House, a classic craftsman home. I love this description, the house that Ivory Soap built, which is, Ivory Soap is one of Procter & Gamble's mm-hmm. products.
How American.
Yes. But you all will recognize it. More exciting is that this was Doc Brown's home in Back to the Future.
I love that house.
Yeah. So you can take a tour of it if you want.
I would love to.
While Jack enjoys the luxuries of living on such a street, he does not make many friends. He's pretty reserved at this young age, but he does read a lot. The book that had the most decisive impact on his career in life was From the Earth to the Moon by Jules Verne.
Okay, so a Doc Brown reference here, because in the third Back to the Future movie, Doc Brown is with Clara Clayton and they're looking up through her telescope and they start talking about this book.
That's Anyways. So funny. I do remember that, but I don't remember the conversation. Well, so for anyone out there, if you're curious, premises, it's about a group of Civil War veterans who decided to escape the Earth and design a giant cannon to shoot themselves into space. And apparently there was just such good detail And with the technical knowledge available at that time, Jules Verne made it seem as though space flight could be made possible. But in the real world, apart from fiction, the idea of building a rocket that could blast one free of Earth's atmosphere was like crazy talk. So some rocket science 101. A rocket is a great example of Newton's third law of motion. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. To get a rocket into the air, the hot gases that result from burning fuel shoot out the back of the rocket downward. So think of the exhaust plume that you see at a rocket launch. That forces the rocket to move upward in the opposite direction. So simple as a concept, but extraordinarily hard practically to get everything right. So it works, it goes where you want, and the whole thing doesn't explode. Rockets have been in use in fireworks and primitive weapons now at this point for about, well, really for hundreds of years. Rocket technology, though, still has not advanced to the point that it's become predictable. They often misfire, and you can't really aim them with much precision. So saying you could design a rocket that would take you to outer space was like saying the mythical unicorn exists, and I'm going to go find it.
So I guess I have to point out that they've been using them for fireworks and weapons and all of that, but often misfired. It sounds horribly dangerous. Right. Okay, go ahead.
Well, At school, Jack is befriended by another student, the tall, handsome, street smart Ed Foreman. They met when Ed broke the nose of a bully brutally attacking Jack on the playground one day. And thus began one of the greatest bromances of all time would one day change the course of history. As it turned out, Ed was also really fascinated by the prospect of designing a rocket to take them to the moon. They began by building simple rockets using the black powder that they would scrape out of fireworks and cherry bombs. They started out in Jack's backyard, which did a number on the landscape. Fortunately, though, Jack lived close to the Arroyo Seco, which is this vast watershed cutting deep into the landscape just west of South Orange Grove Boulevard. It was a wilderness back then, but now it's had a lot of development. The Rose Bowl Stadium is there, lots of trails, park areas, a kids' museum, and of course, the Jet Propulsion Lab was built there.
I wonder how much Jack destroyed his backyard as a kid.
It was described as having looked like the surface of the moon.
Oh my gosh.
A lot.
I'm sure his mom was happy.
Right. I know. It's like, where were the adults? But then you're kind of glad they weren't there because...
Would this have all happened?
Would this have happened? But worse could have happened. Well, somewhere in his teen years, Jack Parsons ran his first experiment with the occult. So he's not just blowing up things in the backyard. Oh, he's now thinking, hey, you know what? It would be a good idea to summon the devil.
Nope.
I saw it speculated maybe he wanted some help with the bullies, but apparently whatever he did went so poorly and whatever he achieved scared him so much there would be no further experimentation with the occult for years to come. But it's like, did you think the devil was going to show up and be your BFF and do your bidding?
Or how did you think it was going to turn out?
I know. That there's
no good ending.
Right. So Jack does stuff that is so brilliant and things that you're just going to keep shaking your head throughout the story and asking yourself why. And there won't be an answer.
There's one of them.
So I'm going to give you details of his rocket science career just in the next few minutes here just to prepare you. There's going to be a little bit more science, but then we're going to go back to the occult because he does eventually return.
So we're going to get really smart in the next couple minutes.
And then we're going to dumb it down by the crazy stuff that he believed and the people he believed in later. So back to Jack's life. So growing up, he's experimenting with a lot of different things. But then he's forced to focus his attention on more practical matters. So like so many on Millionaire's Row, like I mentioned, Jack's grandfather lost his fortune in the Great Depression, and he died not long after. The year is now 1932, and Jack is 18 and he needs to financially support his mother and grandmother. He found the perfect job at the Hercules Powder Company in Los Angeles. So not only would this help pay the bills, but it would also provide Jack with a vast treasure trove of explosives to learn about and experiment with, which I think is kind of code for he stole stuff. Ed Foreman also apprenticed as a machinist at the Hercules Powder Company. So in their free time, they continued to work on building a rocket, but just with better toys and equipment. Ed focusing on developing the motor casings while Jack would make the fuel. So it's not surprising, though, that Jack and Ed, even with all this access and knowledge, would hit obstacles. They don't have the equipment to measure the speed and power at which Jack's fuel concoctions burn. They need formal training in mathematics, chemistry, engineering. And while Jack's experience has been focused on rockets powered by black powder, a group called the American Interplanetary Society suggests after experimentation that actually liquid propellants are the future because they are more powerful and their speed is more easily controlled. Then, one fateful day in 1935, after reading about one of its grad students' lectures on rockets, Jack and Ed decided to visit the nearby California Institute of Technology, or Caltech for short.
Okay.
So Caltech is a world-renowned institution today, but even back then, it was a powerhouse. Scientists you may have heard of, maybe Hubble, Einstein, Oppenheimer, Bohr, they're all cycling through this institution in various different capacities and various different times. Jack and Ed were introduced, though, when they went over to an aeronautics graduate student named Frank Molina, who, like Jack, had also become fascinated with rockets and the possibility of space exploration after having read From the Earth and to the Moon.
Very popular.
But because rocket science was not yet established as anything close to a reasonable course of study, Frank Molina decided his work would be on the next best thing, enrolling at the Guggenheim, or now Graduate Aerospace Laboratories of the California Institute of Technology, which is called GALSIT, thank goodness.
Holy cow.
Say that 10 times fast.
Oh my gosh.
The laboratory itself was built around an impressive 10-foot wind tunnel used to perform over 1,000 tests on all sorts of scale models of newly designed aircraft, including most of the Allied aircraft used in World War II.
Interesting.
I know. So working at the lab, Frank was well aware that aircraft engines have their limitations because they rely on oxygen in the atmosphere for their fuel to burn. They can't travel above an altitude where the amount of oxygen is no longer sufficient. In space, where there is no oxygen, that's not a challenge for a rocket because it's designed to bring its own oxidizer with it.
Okay.
Frank, realizing teaming up with Jack and Ed to build a rocket actually made a lot of sense because they each have unique skills that are critical to designing a functioning rocket. So he pairs up with them. Frank would be the person who knows the theory, has the ties to the major institution, Caltech. Ed is a talented engineer, and Jack has knowledge and experience with rocket fuel. But to get sponsorship, they can't say they want to build a rocket to go to space because that sounds crazy. But rockets actually would be really useful to, say, the meteorological department at Caltech if they could carry instruments 25 miles up in the atmosphere to get information. So they try that pitch. Ultimately, the legendary Theodore von Karman, director of GALSET, gives an initial blessing to the newly formed team. He is an aeronautics expert known as the father of supersonic flight and quite a character. Sociable as he was intelligent, smoking cigars, drinking bourbon out of tall glasses, taking time to get to know his students personally, and also flirting with their wives.
Nice.
We all have to have a flaw. Oh, God. He's the least flawed person in the story, I
think. Oh my gosh.
So far as we know. He saw the enthusiasm and potential of this team of three, and unlike others who were not maybe as dynamic and astute and might have been stuck on the whole, well, you're not enrolled at Caltech, you don't have formal training, he actually realized, hey, we might have something there, even though they don't check the traditional boxes.
Yeah.
He can't give them funding, but he can give them access to lab equipment at GALSIT after hours. Frank Molina describes their work in a Caltech's Engineering and Science publication in 1968. During the next 3 years, we received no pay for our work. And during the first year, we bought equipment, some secondhand, with whatever money we could pull together. Most of our work was done on weekends or at night. So they are slaving away, but they're getting some good results that look promising. Theodore von Karman agrees to let the group conduct rocket tests then on Caltech's campus, which is a bad idea.
Oh, no.
My first reaction was, okay, that's crazy. So you're going to allow experiments with explosives with unproven technology around people, your most promising scientists. What could go wrong? A lot. Fortunately, nobody is killed. But there is a there's an incident where there's toxic stuff released into the air during an experiment. It rusts all this expensive and not easily replaced scientific equipment throughout building. And there is an explosion where a piece of metal might have actually taken out Frank Molina if he hadn't just moved from the spot in its trajectory.
Oh, my gosh.
And that is how they got the name the Suicide Squad.
How fitting.
With all of this hard work, you might think Jack would have no time or energy for a personal life. But oh, does he make time for one. By now, Jack is transformed into a very attractive man with snazzy attire, how he's described. I look at him and I
don't see the attraction, I guess.
I can't see it because I think I know too much. So, I don't know. But that is how he is described. He definitely had something going on. You'll see why later. He always wears a suit, even when performing dangerous tests. A friend recalled, quote, "I don't think I ever saw him without a vest. And I think I recall when I was looking at pictures of him, he was working in a black leather jacket in the Arroyo Seco like he's George Michael." Now, Jack gets married in 1935 to a woman named Helen Northrup. Helen is described as smart, well-read, and she is fascinated by his obsession with building a rocket and going to the moon one day. And I think the fact that she resisted his charms initially and played hard to get kind of made it a bit of a game and probably intrigued him a bit more, too. In 1939, Jack and Helen decided to attend their first Gnostic Mass of the Church of Thelema.
So okay, here we go.
Hold on to your seat. Here we go. So I'm going to let a Vice article summarize the Mass. It's described as, quote, "a weird take on the Catholic Mass. On a black and white stage stood an altar embossed with hieroglyphic patterns, a host of candles, and an upright coffin covered with a gauze curtain out of which the group's caped leader would appear."
It sounds like a vampire.
But not.
It sounds like a vampire.
It does. So also, I mean, maybe kind of metal. Poetry was read. Swords are drawn, breasts kissed, and lances stroked.
It sounds like an episode of What We Do in the Shadows.
I don't know about this part, though, because it goes on to say, as it goes on to say, obviously, it was a highly charged sexual atmosphere. Wine was drunk, and cakes were consumed. These cakes, by the way, are referred to formally as the Cake of Light. Ingredients include flour, oil, leavening agents, and bodily fluids.
Oh.
And when I say bodily fluids, whatever you're thinking, all
like,
of the above.
Oh my
yeah,
God.
Don't make me say it. It's all of them. So, yeah,
gross.
I'll just leave it there. Moving on. Jack might have become interested in attending the Mass when he learned it was created by a magician named Aleister Crowley.
Oh, no.
Jack had read some of Crowley's writings, which spoke of hidden knowledge and magical worlds. So, we're going to back up and talk about Aleister because he's a character for one. And also, Jack put so much time and money into his ideas, and you're going to be like, why? So I'm going to give you a small preview also, too, of what goes on in this group. But in episode 2 next week, we're going to really spill the tea.
Okay.
Aleister, let's get back to him. So he was born in England to parents that practiced a very strict branch of Christianity. His father died of cancer early in his life, and given the very austere morality of the church, he not only rejects the religion, but actively rebels against it. Aleister's father was an heir to a brewing fortune, which he inherited, and that gives him tons of freedom to experience many things. He's smart, he goes to Oxford, he doesn't finish, but he becomes, among many things, a chess master, an accomplished mountain climber, he writes a lot of poetry, books, and he does a lot of drugs. Okay. Primarily heroin. And he also really enjoys a number of different sex fetishes, which he practices with a lot of people, including sex workers.
Oh my gosh.
So, like, think of when I read about him, I thought of the youngest son in the House of Usher.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's like that. Oh, like that guy. But just added magic.
It comes to a terrible end.
So if you guys haven't seen House of Usher, I really, as an aside,
it's good.
Highly yeah. recommend it. And Dixon from Alias is in it.
He is.
We're huge fans of Alias. So, yeah, that's like who I picture when I picture him.
Yeah, that kind of brings it to life.
So Alistair marries later. It doesn't last. I don't even know why. But this is in 1904, and he goes on a honeymoon to Cairo, Egypt. But this is the important part.
Okay.
Something life-changing happens. Alistair is visited by a being not of this world named Iwas, who has a lot to say. Exactly between noon and 1 p.m. on April's 8th, 9th, and 10th.
That's very precise.
It is. Iwas dictates to Alistair what would become known as the Book of the Law. This would later become the basis of the Church of Thelema and the Gnostic Mass Jack and his wife attended. Let's talk about the central belief of this church he started.
Okay.
Are you ready for it?
I'm a little afraid, but yes, let's
do it. Do what thou wilt. Do what thou wilt.
Oh my gosh.
That's the logic.
I feel like there are many philosophers that would have an issue with that.
I don't even think you need to be a philosopher. You could just be whatever you want to.
I think it's utilitarianism
uh-huh.
that is like whatever you do for the greater good, that's like the best route to go.
There's no greater
this
good
here.
This
is the opposite of
right.
that.
And it's going to cause a lot of problems later. And when he's like, I don't understand why this didn't scale and become an enduring institution. Well, you're kind of operating with the logic of a toddler.
Really? Yeah.
It doesn't work.
It's about what a two-year-old does.
But he does have one guardrail, though. You know, there is a guardrail. Every action is moral as long as it advances your will and your destiny. So if you do this and you follow his stuff and pay him fees, you too can get your own holy guardian like Iwas was to Aleister Crowley. Also, you can buy the Book of the Law on Kindle for 99 cents. I don't recommend it. I did, and I did not read it closely. I just remember feeling like, I feel like I'm being yelled at. I feel like this does not make sense. And I then had a strong urge to switch to a book with pictures and grab some Tylenol. But I had to at least pick it up because I was like, wait, dude, you said it took you only 3 hours to write this. Like, can you even mm-hmm. write a book that's substantial in 3 hours? And it's actually super short, so possible. I mean, I could have done a back of the envelope calculation, but mm-hmm. guys, I have to rein it in somewhere. So anyway. So I think at this point, this is a really good place to pick up a picture of Alistair on Google image search. April, this is Alistair.
Oh my gosh. Look at his eyes in this one.
I think he's like blue steel from the nose up. Yeah.
Kind of. He kind of has the same face in every picture.
Yeah. He has the thing going for sure. We'll have an Instagram up.
I think my favorite one is either the hat or the one where he sort of looks like an elf from Lord of the Rings.
Elf crossed with blue steel. Yes. So yes. We'll put this all on our our Instagram. We'll have lots of fun pictures up there that go with this story. So this is not the first or last religion formed when a power from beyond communicates a message to a mortal being who then writes it down. So, and I don't want to come across as dismissive to someone's chosen faith if that's what they believe, but in this case, I am just going to cut to the chase and tell you why Alistair is full of shit. So on the top of the list, and I think we've already started the list, the dude faked his own death. So
oh my gosh.
One source okay. said it was to drum up interest for a painting exhibition. And another was it was because he was traveling with this woman and it was like, I think I'm kind of done with her. And rather than having a conversation, he just was like, all right, time to pick my
dad. Can you imagine if you're the woman? And he's the one that left you?
I know. All I know is that if that woman ever played Two Truths and a Lie, she would win it. Every single time.
Oh my gosh.
He's also just known for being a jerk. He plays people off of each other. He has a steady drug addiction, obviously. It's mm-hmm. heroin, but there's other stuff.
I also wonder if he took his drugs at the same time every day, like on his honeymoon, to get the same message at the same time every day.
They definitely were doing stuff. I don't remember the specifics, but yeah. So was it the drugs or was it the voicemail from beyond? Well, he also figures out a new church is nothing without followers, and Alistair needs to find some followers. So he's like, all right, I'm just going to hijack this quasi-Masonic organization over here called the Ordo Templi Orientis, also known as the OTO. He works his way into leadership, he rewrites the rituals, and he gets it to adopt the Book of the Law. So many of the rituals involve magic, but with a K. And what makes it magic with a K is that this is not your run-of-the-mill parlor trick stuff. This is mystical and spiritual. And he says that when you get the magic right, it's like science when you combine the right ingredients and you get a predictable result every time. And if you progress along a set path of activities and pay him an annual fee, you too will share the secrets of magic.
I'm not like regular magic. I'm cool magic. I have a K.
I'm snake oil. I mean, this guy had to find a way to pay his bills and his drugs when his inheritance ran out. So, you know.
Oh my gosh.
You got to do it. You got to do. This is a great quote in that Vice article I referenced. Jack, quote, became especially intrigued by Crowley's belief that sex could be an intrinsic component of magical rituals, lifting the practitioner onto a higher plane of consciousness. What 24-year-old wouldn't be?
So true.
And so I had never heard of sex magic, and I was walking past a bookshop, and I saw that it was, like, on display, like, front and center, and I was like, what? Hold on. I've never heard of this before, and now...
Now
Is it Alistair speaking?
He's giving you a
tempting
message.
To pick it up. I did not.
I'm very proud of you.
Oh, boy. Okay. So, but while Jack and Helen are embarking on this mystical world of magic, to get back to that, troubling developments in the real world are going to soon put even more urgency and funding into the Suicide Squad's effort to develop a rocket. Not to go to the moon, but for another use case that is very much of this world. Frank Molina piqued Theodore von Karman's interest, remember the Caltech sponsor, when he delivered a lecture suggesting a very interesting use case for rockets. When strapped under the wings of a plane, they could potentially improve its performance. Karman sat on the National Academy of Sciences Committee on Army Air Corps Research, which was asked to study how they can get aircraft to take off in dangerous combat zones where they don't have the luxury of long runways or time.
Oh.
So with Theodore von Karman's sponsorship, the Suicide Squad, not calling itself on the application, but they get funding to study and develop such a rocket engine. But they don't call it that because, again, that's crazy. So they call this innovation Jet-Assisted Takeoff, or JATOS for short.
Okay.
So that is why the Jet Propulsion Lab is not the Rocket Propulsion Lab. I always kind of wondered that. Oh, they're two different things.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Because they swapped out the terms. Mm-hmm. Now, Hitler invades Poland on September 1st, 1939, which officially starts World War II. But even with the U.S. more than 2 years away from entering, the military sees the writing on the wall. In the least to help their allies, they start pouring more money into grants for the team to develop after the initial plans look promising. The Suicide Squad moves back to Jack and Ed's old stomping grounds, the Arroyo Seco, because, duh, it was never really a good idea, even though it was definitely convenient to have the equipment there. But they can at least use the funding, not a lot. A lot has to go to the research, but they put up these wood and corrugated sheet metal shacks, which were like hot as an oven in the summer, which of course I don't think Jack was wearing his leather jacket. And then he's in a suit
or a leather jacket.
I mean, that's commitment. But in winter, there's no heat and rain floods the entire encampment. So this is just, it's like tough all around, tough intellectually, tough physically. So you might think that's super exhausting. Jack cannot be spending much time on his occult interest. But actually, Jack and Helen join OTO's Agape Lodge, which is the chapter in Los Angeles. And Jack is eager to recruit. As the JADO funding and team expands, he invites Caltech students part of the project over, including Frank Molina's wife, Lillian, at a party at the OTO house when Frank is away on one of his frequent trips to the East Coast to, you know, do the real work of talking to funders. She recalled the people in attendance. Some had on masks. Some were in costumes. Women are walking around in see-through togas and weird makeup. Some of them are dressed up like animals. Then she gets to the mass. One of these women was rather short and dumpy, and she came out of this coffin and began to flit around and dance. And I began to think, this is really weird, really strange. Then some young man in a loincloth appeared. So she never went back.
I don't blame her. Like, I'd be like, what is happening
right
now? It's
like right a now? Step up from a theme fraternity party. I really hope she peaced out before the Cake of Horrors.
Oh, my God. Oh, I hope she didn't eat the cake.
I know. So, and if she did, she never found out what it was made of. So she told Frank about it, but Frank just kind of rolled his eyes and said, yeah, Jack's going to be Jack. Frank was this guy who was like, he would just do his work. Like, he saw the value and he turned his head the other way.
Yeah.
He never really got into it. So,
I mean, sometimes when people are really talented at one thing,
I know,
they're super weird in other parts of their life.
And they are, he's a special butterfly at this point. You know, not a lot of people are willing to do what he's doing.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
All right.
So the groups, though, that are over at the OTO house, they go late into the night. And in the words of George Pendle, quote, an unkempt Parsons could be seen shuffling across the arroyo, flinching in perceptible agony as his rockets belched and screeched. So I bet the guy they recruited to fly the plane for their first JADO run, his name, by the way, was Homer Boucher, I think is how you pronounce it. He's probably like, is this a bad idea? Like,
can this guy, what am I flying right now?
Designed by that guy?
Yeah. Thank goodness he wasn't at the party too.
Oh my goodness. But believe it or not, on August 12th, 1941, he successfully flies the first plane with rocket power. But there's little time to celebrate because there is still so much work to do. On December 7th, 1941, Pearl Harbor was attacked and the U.S. officially entered World War II. Now there is a wartime urgency to mass produce JADOs, but there is a problem. The rocket fuel is still not shelf stable. Jack finds he can't just fill the rocket engines combustion chambers with his black powder-based fuel because if he lets it sit overnight, changes in temperature would cause the fuel to contract or expand accordingly, causing it to crack. So when the rocket engines is ignited, flames spread throughout all the cracks, rapidly increasing the pressure, and now you have not a rocket, but a bomb. But then, Jack remembers something from all those years reading obscure historical literature. There is this flaming liquid weapon called Greek fire, recorded as early as the 5th century BC in Sparta, but most known for its use by the Byzantine Empire during sea battles. They used these bronze tubes attached to their ships to shoot out streams of fiery liquid to set enemy ships ablaze because this substance can burn even on water.
Oh.
So, to bring it back to Game of Thrones here, remember how the Lannisters used wildfire to destroy Stannis' fleet in the Battle of the Blackwater?
It's like that.
It's just like that. Well, not exactly, but so, and I also can't help but remember that scene where Cersei is due to be prosecuted in the Great Sept of Baelor, and Marjorie says, Cersei knows the consequences of not being here, and yet she is still not here. And you see her standing in the Red Keep as she smugly watches it blow up because she arranged to ignite the wildfire underneath the whole thing. And if I plot spoiled it for you, what are you doing not having seen Game of Thrones? I know the last few seasons were disappointing.
And also, still. Nerd alert.
Shut up.
but also I know what you're talking about.
Well, now you know.
It's a fantastic show. Okay, really anyways.
Is. Okay. I'm really proud of that reference. To this day, nobody knows exactly how Greek fire is made because it was such a closely guarded secret, obviously. But Jack remembers a theory that one of the key ingredients was asphalt, to which I say, duh. I'm totally kidding.
I'm like, what? Am I supposed to know this? No.
Like, if you start asking me questions next layer down of understanding of how this all works, like, uh-huh. It totally breaks down. So Jack thinks, why not throw out the black powder and use asphalt as the fuel? So off to the lab he goes, he melts roofing tar, adds potassium perchlorate as an oxidizer because that will allow the tar to breathe and catch fire. He pours his melted concoction into the rocket chamber and moves it around to fill every gap. Once cool, it looks like a hardened paving tar, and most importantly, no cracks. And voila, just like that, there's now a mixture called Galsit 53, which is actually not just like that because it's 53 because they failed 52 times before.
Oh, nice. Okay.
But this performs beautifully, and it can be stored indefinitely and is overall much safer to handle. This castable fuel is an entirely new category of fuel, which Frank Molina said is, quote, one of the most important discoveries in the long history of solid rockets. And now it's showtime. So on March 19th, 1942, the Suicide Squad forms Aerojet Corps, along with Theodore von Karman as its leader, and it becomes one of the world's largest manufacturer of rockets. They contract with the U.S. military, and privy to their very top secret work, you would think Jack and Ed would start, you know, acting like real scientists. But as George Pendle notes, quote, when they showed up for work, which could be at any hour, they were usually a startling sight. Whether it was Ed Foreman arriving, cut and bloodied after his most recent motorbike crash, or Parsons reciting poetry to the secretary,
oh gosh,
causing squeals of delight on his every appearance. I don't know why.
Pass.
Right, hard pass. The company's core scientist seemed not so much unprofessional as insane. And this is not going to change anytime soon. Jack, now incredibly successful and finally making good money after years of scraping by, decides to return back to his childhood street, Orange Grove Boulevard, after years of living in more modest accommodations with Helen. Given Jack's very deep commitment to the OTO, this home will also now be its new headquarters. But all is not well, because I forgot to mention, also the members are swingers, so they're swapping partners. Okay. And Jack and Helen have chosen other people as their main.
Oh, okay.
Right? So even though they're married, uh-huh, technically. So people get married, but then they swap. I don't know how they decide. Sure. But most importantly, Jack and Helen's choices of who becomes their primary person could, mm-hmm, not be more scandalous. And things really go up another notch when one L. Ron Hubbard moves in. Have you heard of L. Ron Hubbard?
Yes, I have.
He is
the founder of Scientology.
Yes. And you have only had a small preview of what happens in the OTO, but you haven't heard anything yet. But you will have to wait until next week to hear the details in part two.
So I'm still looking at these pictures of Alistair. Amazon has this one with the triangle hat in stock. I kind of wonder what the symbol is, though, on his hat up here.
Maybe we will find out next time. But if you want to see this and more pictures, you can follow us at Dark City Pod, all one word, on Instagram and Facebook. Our website is www.darkcitypodcast.com, though it's not quite live yet, but will be in early April. Until next week.